I would like to welcome, if they are in the room, some more of our out-of-state visitors, Bob and Donna Seliger, if they're in the room. And they're not. So we'll give them virtual applause, and everyone on ACB Radio World can hear that too. Bob and Donna are probably in exhibits. Okay, thank you. All right, and in the interest of flexibility, and if anything and everything can happen that's not schedule will, here we go. I'd like to go ahead and introduce Jerry Consler, who is the chair of our Constitution and Bylaws Committee, for the reading of a constitutional amendment. So, Jerry, again, this is only a reading. And so we will have Jerry on to do the reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Fella called 911 and said his wife had just been attacked by a warthog. And the dispatcher said, "Oh, it's terrible. We'll send somebody over right away. What's your address?" He said, 1220 Eucalyptus Road. Dispatcher said, "Will you spell that for me, please?" He hesitated a few seconds and said, "I'll just drag her on over to Oak Street." Article 5, Meetings, Section 5.4 reads, "Each such meeting shall be known as the Convention of the California Council of the Blind." We have an amendment proposed to modify this. It has two parts. The first is to add the words conference and in front of the word convention. The word conference would be capitalized. And at the end of the word convention, to put a comma and then this expression, "sometimes referred to herein as the," quote, capital C, "convention," comma, end quote, "of the California Council of the Blind," so that the new section would read, "Each such meeting shall be known as the conference and convention, sometimes referred to herein as the convention of the California Council of the Blind." We will vote on this proposed amendment tomorrow morning. It'll be up for discussion at that point. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm seeing through my papers here because our first speaker isn't here. Yet. What I'd like to do is allow for Terry Grossman to come up. She has asked for a few minutes, five, to speak to the group very quickly. Terry, are you still in the room?
I am.
You are?
I'm on my way.
Wonderful. She has her roller skates. We're all moving around here, and here's Terry Grossman.
Thank you. May I stand? Let's see if I can get this out of here. No, I can't. So I'll stand anyway. Thank you very much for giving me 5 minutes of your very valuable time. I'm an audio describer in Los Angeles, and I know you are all aware of the recent passage of the Video Restoration Act by the United States Congress. Cheers for them. Cheers for them. And further, that the President of the United States used the words "video description" in a proclamation that he signed. So also props to President Obama for that. And I am here to seek your support for an affiliate chapter devoted to audio description. Reason being that while we are delighted with the passage of this legislation, I am fearful that description will go the way of captioning, which is that it will become a lot more prevalent and also very bad. So I would propose that we join together and we have an affiliate chapter that would be the best informed consumers of description on the planet and would also be able to advocate for the best description that you can receive. So that's a proposal I bring to you, and I hope there's more enthusiasm than just me for it. And is there a show of hands? Does this sound like something that people would be interested in? Okay, enough of a show of hands. We will pursue this. We will put an article, I hope, in your publication with some contact information, and we will get rolling. And I appreciate your time for that. And I wanted to also point out that we are going to overcome technical obstacles to get you the Rose Parade Street on your ACB radio with my good friend Vin Metz over here.
Yay!
So we're going to do that for you, and keep your fingers crossed, and there'll be more information about that. And I thank you so much for your time. I know how valuable it is and how much you have to do. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much, Terry. Our next speaker has just arrived, so it was absolutely wonderful. His name is Dr. Ramachandran, and we have someone to give an introduction for him. We have Tom Carnes, who is a CCB member from Oceanside, California, and Tom will go ahead and do the introduction for Dr. Ramachandran. Tom?
Good afternoon. A number of years ago, 15 years ago, when I finally went totally blind after some 35 years of losing my vision slowly to retinitis pigmentosa, I discovered that I could still see. I was totally blind, and yet I could see my fingers wiggling, and I could see my white cane going back and forth in front of me. I could do this in a dark room with my eyes shut. So I knew something was going on. So I realized that I could still see my fingers wiggling, even in a dark room with my eyes closed. And I figured, well, something's going on in my brain, because my brain knows where my fingers are, and it's creating somehow an image. And I talked to a number of ophthalmologists about this, and they didn't know what was happening. And I saw a NOVA program about vision. It was when there was different senses were on different weeks of the NOVA in a series. And in that NOVA program, Dr. Ramachandran, who's here today, discussed blind vision and several other things that he's involved with as far as people dealing with the phantom pain of a missing limb and so forth. So a very interesting NOVA program, and it was described so I could understand what was going on. And then in the credits it said that he was at University of California, San Diego. And so I said, well, I looked him up, I found out an email address, and I sent a message off to him, and after a couple of messages, I got a reply. And I went to his offices. He's the in charge of the Brain and Cognition Center there at the Neurological Institute, I think it's called, at the University of California, San Diego Medical School. And he has a bunch of PhD students, and he assigned me to one of them to find out just what was going on with me. I demonstrated that my range of where I could see my fingers wiggling and so forth. Then they even though I have a really bad claustrophobia, I managed to go into their fMRI machine perhaps a dozen times. Well, they had me wiggle my fingers, and they watched my brain and see which parts lit up and where the activity was. And this is apparently was going in the information from my physical awareness of my hand location and so forth was going into the visual cortex at a fairly low level, which was interesting. My wife got to watch the scan of my brain, saw my brain actually working for a change. And so I just spent a couple of months doing this, and I learned a lot about how the brain works, but I'd like to introduce Dr. Ramachandran, MD, PhD, as I said, head of the Cognition and Brain Center, and he'll speak to us about this aspect of the brain. Doctor?
Well, I'm just going to keep this very informal. I understand it's about 30 minutes long. I'm a professor at the Center for Brain and Cognition at UCSD. My early training was in medicine, but for the last 20, 30 years, I've been mainly doing research on fundamental aspects of human brain function, asking basic questions about how the brain works, and also can you develop new treatments for different types of brain disorders like chronic pain and stroke and phantom pain and other common brain disorders, as well as some rare brain disorders. Now, I want you to think for a minute about what the problem we're confronted with is. The human brain is a lump of jelly, about 3 kilograms, which you can hold, 3 pounds, which you can hold in the palm of your hand. And this lump of jelly can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space, contemplate the meaning of infinity, and contemplate itself contemplating. Asking, who am I? What am I doing here? You know, the lofty philosophical. So it turns out that the brain is made up of fundamental units called the neurons, which are the structural and functional units of the nervous system. And each neuron can be connected 1,000 or 10,000 other neurons by synapses, what are called synapses. And these synapses are points of exchange of information, and there are about 1,000 to 10,000 synapses between adjacent neurons. And so based on the synapse can be either inhibitory or excitatory, it can be on, it can be off, and based on this information, somebody has figured out that the number of possible brain states exceeds the number of elementary particles in the known universe. So this gives you some idea of how the complexity of the problem we're dealing with and trying to understand. Now, there are many ways of approaching the brain, functions of the brain. One is doing brain imaging. Ask somebody to wiggle their finger, see which part of the brain lights up, blink their eyes, see what part of the brain lights up, do mathematical arithmetic and mathematical calculations in their head, in a region called the left angular gyrus sub. And I'm oversimplifying it, of course, but it is easy, it is possible to understand different parts of the brain and their functioning, depending on what parts of the brain light up during various tasks. And if you look at the history of neurology, there have been two extreme points of view over the last two centuries. One extreme is the idea that different brain functions are localized in specific regions of the brain. There are specialized regions for vision, for aspects of vision like color vision, motion perception, and of course for hearing, and for touch, and even for things like memory. There's a structure called hippocampus involved in memory and learning. The other end of the spectrum is the notion that the brain functions more or less as a whole, that any one part is as good as any other part. I mean, obviously it's good to have a lot of it, but it's a sort of so-called holistic view of brain function. And the pendulum has swung back and forth between these two extreme approaches to brain function. And I'm sort of, as you'll go along, I'm not going to take sides. I'm going to say there are specialized regions of the brain in the adult, but these are highly malleable and flexible in their function. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a few examples of this, given our time limits, just a few examples of this sort of malleability of function in the brain. So the question is, given this extraordinary number of neurons and synapses, how is the brain wired up? Is it primarily by genes, but wired up by the genome, or is it primarily by exposure to the visual environment? How much of it is nature and how much of it is nurture? This nature-nurture debate about brain function and brain connections, again, has been going on for 200 years with no clear resolution. But I'm on the side of the people who say there's a lot of malleability of brain function, also known as plasticity of brain function. What's the evidence for that? Well, I began studying vision in the early days of my career, but then switched to trying to understand chronic pain in the nervous system, and especially a form of pain called phantom limb pain. So if you amputate an arm, or the arm gets crushed in a car accident and you amputate it, or there's a diabetic gangrene and you amputate a leg or an arm, the patient continues to vividly feel the presence of that missed arm or leg, and this is called a phantom arm or a phantom leg. And it's very vivid, the patient's not hallucinating. In other words, he's not delusional, he doesn't think the arm has actually come back, but it's a very vivid sensory experience. You'll say the phantom is waving goodbye, is reaching out to grab a cup of tea. It's a very spontaneous experience and a very vivid, and he can volitionally move his phantom. But in many patients, the phantom is fixed and paralyzed, often in an awkward position, like the fist clenched. And this is excruciatingly painful for the patient. And just think about it, it's not a real arm, it's a phantom arm with a phantom clench, with a phantom cramp causing phantom pain. And for a long time, people thought this was just psychological, and the patient used to get very annoyed by this. And then we came along and showed there's some change in the circuitry of the brain that's causing the phantom pain. And you can actually treat the phantom pain using some relatively simple procedures. So here's the guy who says his phantom hand, left hand, is clenched in a painful manner. And if only he could unclench it using volition, maybe it'll relieve the pain. But he's unable to volitionally unclench it. It remains clenched. So I said, what if you give him visual feedback, false visual feedback, saying that the phantom hand is actually unclenching? Would it relieve the pain? Well, how do you give him false visual feedback from a phantom? He doesn't have an arm. So we hit on the technique of putting a mirror in the middle of the table, and the patient puts his phantom hand on the side of the mirror. Let's say the left arm is a phantom arm with a phantom clench, and he puts it on the left side of the mirror. Right side of the mirror is shiny, and he puts his right hand, which is normal or intact, on the right side of the mirror and looks inside the mirror. And what he's going to see is a reflection of his right hand inside the mirror, as though the left arm has come back, the phantom has come back. Now if he opens and closes the real hand and looks in the mirror, it looks like the phantom is opening and closing his fingers. And the astonishing thing is many people, even people years of phantom limb pain, who had that hand clenched or in an awkward position and very painful, instantly the arm movements come back, the movements of the phantom come back, and he gets a relief from the pain. This doesn't come back immediately in some people, but some people it comes back immediately. And if they close their eyes, it doesn't work. So the visual feedback is critical. And on the other hand, if you repeat the experiment several times a week, several times a month, eventually he can throw away the mirror and he can move his phantom limb. And this liberates or animates the phantom and liberates the patient from pain. Same thing has now been used in stroke rehabilitation. You know, most people think stroke is irreversible damage to the brain, to the fibers that go from the motor pathways in the brain down to from the motor cortex in the brain, down through the spinal cord, to the muscles which you control. That's how you move your arm. Now these fibers are damaged in stroke, you get permanently paralyzed. But in some patients, it's not the fibers that are damaged as much as the brain undergoes a swelling and temporarily interrupts the flow of signals, the cortex to the spinal cord. But even though the interruption is temporary and happens for a few weeks or a couple of months, the patient is left with a permanent paralysis, as though the passage of signals has been blocked temporarily, becomes permanent, even though the fibers are still there and they're intact. And we found that if you put a mirror and give him the impression that the arm is moving again, the stroke paralyzed arm moving again, this kicks in visually and helps him start moving his his paralyzed arm. Now you get a lot of restoration of movement in about 1 out of 5 patients, some restoration in one out of two or three out of five, and nothing happens in two out of five patients. So just to say, not everybody recovers. But in the people whom it recovers, it's remarkable because they've tried all kinds of other rehab procedures to no avail, and using the mirror feedback seems to help them help store arm function in the paralyzed arm. And I could go on like that, giving other examples. Another example is called learned pain, called RSD, or reflex sympathetic dystrophy. I know that sounds like a technical name, so I'll explain it. Most of the time, when you have a small injury to a hand, like a small fracture in your hand bones, there's excruciating pain initially, and the hand gets immobilized. It's a reflex immobilization to prevent further tissue injury to the hand. This is common, and slowly the hand heals, and the finger movements come back. But in some patients, the pain is permanent. and the fingers are permanently paralyzed. And the inflammation of the fingers and the pain spreads from the hand into the forearm, into the entire arm. So this happens in maybe 1 out of 30 or 1 out of 40 patients. With often a trivial injury, the entire arm gets paralyzed and painful. Again, in these patients, mirror visual feedback, as we now call it, has been successful in having the patient move the paralyzed, painful arm, sometimes virtually instantly, and often causing a dramatic relief from pain in the dystrophic arm and relief from inflammation. So what I'm driving at here is the old model of the brain, which I was raised on as a medical student, was the idea that all these 100 billion neurons are hooked up to each other, but the connections are largely laid down by the genome, are present at birth, present even in the fetus, present at birth, and once they're laid down, there's nothing much you can do to modify these connections in the adult brain. That was what people believed until 15 years ago. Now the view is, partly based on our work, but partly based on work done by a number of groups throughout the United States, throughout the world, the connections in the brain are highly malleable, so much so you should really think of the brain as neurons in a state of reversible equilibrium, dynamic equilibrium. So different brain parts, even though they are specialized, they are in a state of dynamic equilibrium with each other, and they are not specialized to begin with. And also there's a tremendous amount of malleability of connections, so that one part of the brain can take over the functions of another part of the brain, especially in infants or in children. But even in adult brain, there's a tremendous amount of malleability of connections. And the brain is, different parts are not only in equilibrium and interacting with other parts, but it's also in equilibrium with the environment that is immersed in. You change the environment, there's changes in the basic circuitry in the brain, not just temporary activation of some part of the brain, but basic changes in circuitry, which explains the efficacy of the mirror. Often, brain disorders involve not permanent damage to a part of the brain. You punch out a module and you lose a function, but often a temporary interruption of function, a temporary inhibition of function, and often a temporary shift in equilibrium, normal. And all you need to do is to press a reset button to reshift the equilibrium back to normal. That's what we're doing with the mirror and phantom pain and stroke and reflexic dystrophy and paralysis of stroke. Now, more relevant to vision, we are, of course, highly visual animals. Primates are highly visual animals. They evolved from nocturnal insectivores scurrying up on the treetops. They didn't make much use of vision, relied mainly on smell as early mammals. But then they became diurnal, came down from the trees and became diurnal, or partly even on the trees, and they started looking for fruits. They became more diurnal and looking for different shades of green. They acquired color vision. Then they become diurnal, and vision became much more prominent in mammals. So mammals became more and more visual in function, especially primates. Up in the treetops to negotiate branches, develop stereo, develop color vision in order to allow them to consume ripe fruit, tell ripe fruits apart from unripe fruits. Okay, these are all the things which propel the evolution of the brain. It kind of seems hard to believe, and we can now solve equations, go to the moon and all of that, but the original incentive for the brain to develop, especially the visual areas of the brain, is because of you wanted to grab fruits and jump from branch to branch. And that takes me to another region of the human brain that's highly specialized, the primate brain, called the left inferior parietal lobule. It's on the side of the brain, especially on the left side. That is involved in skilled movements. So if I have a vertical branch, your brain automatically adjusts all the muscles of the hand so you can reach out and grab the vertical branch without necessarily any feedback. You can do a ballistic movement of the hand and grab the branch. If it's a horizontal branch, your fingertips and your arm and your hand move horizontally straight towards the branch. You don't have to do feedback adjustment except minimally, and then you grab the branch. Now, why is this so important? Of course, it's important in primates for grabbing fruits and grabbing objects in the environment, but it's also if you're up on the treetops jumping from branch to branch and there are hundreds of branches, you want to jump onto the branch that will support you, you have to do all this rapid computation of the angles of the branches and all of that. And that's done by coordinating vision with touch and muscle sense, what Mr. Kearns earlier mentioned, who, by the way, has volunteered in many of our experiments. I've known Mr. Kearns for over a decade now, I think.
Oh, I think 6 years.
It's only 6 years, okay. So we've been in touch for a long time, and he's been kind enough to come and volunteer for tedious, sometimes tedious, research in our lab, and participated cheerfully and always been inquisitive about what's going on in his brain. So the left angular gyrus, left inferior parietal lobules, has cells which are rich in what we call mirror neurons. They'll fire when you show a vertical banana, or they'll also fire when the monkey reaches for the banana. So the motor cells are hooked up to the visual cells in a very precise manner. These are called mirror neurons, recently discovered by Ricciolati. So mirror neuron, to repeat, is a neuron which will fire, kind of mirror neuron, will fire when you move your hand and reach out and grab a peanut. This has been known for 5 decades. Okay, so these are motor command neurons in the motor centers of your brain. So you reach out and grab a peanut, one neuron fires. If you pull a lever, another neuron fires. If you push something, another neuron fires. If you take something, put it in your mouth, there's another neuron that fires. These are motor command neurons. These are not mirror neurons. But a subset of these neurons, astonishingly, about one-fifth to one-sixth of these neurons, the neuron will fire even when the person or the monkey watches another person reaching out and grabbing the peanut. So here's a neuron that fires if I reach out and grab a peanut, but also fires when I watch you reaching out and grab a peanut. It's almost like ESP. But of course, it's not ESP. What's going on is the brain is taking the visual information and transforming it into motor commands. That's why the neuron, same neuron, fires. So these are very important. This is allowing me, by merely watching you, to figure out what your intentions are. It's a mind-reading neuron. It's able to understand, doing a virtual reality, what's somebody else's head, and to figure out their motives and their intentions. And we've been called the Machiavellian. We're very good at figuring out in social situations what's going on using vision and putting ourselves in somebody else's shoes, which is what the neurons are doing. This is another thing that we've been studying in our lab, the functions of mirror neurons in the human brain. Now, as far as vision itself is concerned, again, there's evidence for tremendous malleability, especially from the two sources of information. Work from Bacchirita a long time ago, but also Pasqualioni at Harvard, showing you can even blindfold somebody who is otherwise sighted for a few days. And what then happens, you touch this person, the touch signals start activating the visual centers in the brain just after a few days. As though the signals are being rerouted from the touch, from the skin. Normally it goes to only to the touch centers in the brain, but now because the sensory signals don't reach the visual area, right? The visual area is hungry for new sensory input, so the sensory input from the touch skin now goes and activates the visual area. This means there's a tremendous amount of liability or plasticity in the brain, and the people saying, naysayers 20 years ago saying there's no flexibility in the adult brain, once you've lost these connections, that's lost forever, that's complete nonsense. What we now know is tremendous malleability, and the question is, how do you tap into this? Can you tap into this malleability to restore visual function, at least to a limited extent? And depends partly, and of course, on whether you're blind from birth or it's acquired later. Depends on various factors. It's been investigating in a very systematic manner in labs throughout the world. We're not directly concerned with visual recovery, but we are very interested in blindness. And the other thing I wanted to say is, I want to explain this because some of you, of course, are blind and haven't seen stereoscopic vision before. Stereoscopic vision is a powerful source of information about depth. What you can get from a cane or from hearing, from echolocation, from who's speaking at a distance, who's nearby. You can also do it through vision, partly through things like motion parallax. But one powerful source of 3D is the fact that you've got two eyes. So you've got two eyes. The two eyes are separated in the head horizontally, not vertically, obviously, horizontally. And each eye looks at the world from a slightly different vantage point. This means if I'm looking at an audience like this, the right eye is looking more of the right side of the people in the audience, the left eye is looking more of the left sides of the people. And the greater the distance between people, the more the difference between the two eyes' images. Is that clear or shall I repeat it?
That's clear.
Okay.
Very clear.
Thank you. Yeah. So the two eyes are getting two different views, and the differences between the two eyes' views is proportional to the relative distances between objects in the world. So the brain can use the differences to compute depth, to compute relative depth, and this is called stereoscopic vision. And it's a tremendously important source of vision in people who got normal vision. Now, in some people, even though they have other aspects of vision, like color vision, visual acuity, everything else is normal, they have no stereo vision. And one example of this is Stereo Sue. That's her nickname. Miss Susan, I don't remember her last name. Someone here might know. She's written a recent book called Recovery from Stereopsis, Stereo Vision. And it's very interesting because most people thought that in childhood, if you have a little squint, or Fourier, one eye is slightly deviating, so that you see double images and the two images are not superposed, you don't develop stereo. All cells in the brain that are responsible for computing stereoscopic depth die out, and there's nothing left, or the connections are lost, and you can't restore those connections. This was the dogma till about 5 years ago. There have always been some people saying, no, there's more vision possible, but ophthalmologists, there was a clash between ophthalmologists, people in optometry, and vision rehab saying it is possible to restore function, and ophthalmologists saying, no, it's not possible. By and large, there are exceptions, of course. The last 10 years, tables have turned, and it looks like there is a tremendous amount of malleability in visual processing. And we know this from Stereo Sue, who did a very simple experiment. She said, well, I can't see stereo, I can see everything else in vision. What are these people talking about when they say there's stereo? So she went and looked at some stereograms, or artificial photographs. What you do is you have a camera where the right eye is, and you take a picture, camera where the left eye is, take a picture, and fuse these pictures in a stereo viewer. So the right eye looks at the right eye's picture, left eye looks at the left eye picture. So the pictures are slightly different, so that everything springs into 3D relief if you and I look at it, or some look at it, who have full normal vision. But people in stereo, Sue looks at it, there's stereo, it all looks flat, even though she can see color and shape and everything else. So she said, what are these people talking about? Let me practice and practice and practice. And after a few months of practice, he started seeing this amazing a butterfly emerging from a cocoon. And she sees things in front of her that she can reach out and grab almost. And then she found the vision, stereo vision, becoming more and more sophisticated. So she's written her memoir. I don't know if it's available yet in Braille. Does anybody here know? Because it's a brilliant, or maybe in an audio book form. I encourage her strongly to produce this audiobook form, so that it's a very vivid narrative about her experiences of restoring, not restoring sight, her sight was okay, but restoring one aspect of sight, which is stereoscopic vision. So I've told you about mirror neurons. Another example of plasticity in the brain is, again, with the somatosensory system instead of the visual system. In visual system, another experiment that's been done a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, was what they did was people who have not had any vision from birth, obviously they still have visual cortex up, what's that visual cortex doing? So they went and stimulated the visual area of the brain using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, completely harmless technique. You go there and you apply a tiny magnetic pulse in the brain. And this magnetic pulse applied to the back of the skull creates a little electrical current, very tiny electrical current, which activates some of the cells. And you activate the cells. So the question is, if you take somebody who's been blind from birth and activate some of the cells in the visual areas, will you suddenly start seeing things, seeing stars or seeing something and saying, my God, this is what people are talking about, I see things. Does that happen? Well, what these investigators found was, that's not what happens when you stimulate the visual cortex. A lot of people say they feel they're being touched. Again, what's happened is there's a touch sensations, these sensations from the skin, which normally go to the touch area of the brain, have now been rerouted and go and activate the visual cortex. So that the visual cells are now being activated by touching the patient. And he sees things. This is what was happening in Tom, I think. So when he started wiggling his fingers or touching it, that sensation is going to the visual cortex, and he was therefore seeing he could actually see something moving. So that was probably what was going on. At that time we didn't know, but now we know why he's experiencing this. Not everybody experiences this, but obviously Tom did. But in Tom's case, the blindness happened later, so therefore what's going on is when you stimulate the visual cortex, when you stimulate touch, for example, that message is going to the visual area in the brain, activating the visual centers, and Tom's brain is able to interpret that as vision, so he sees the hand moving. But blind from birth, when I touch your skin, when I stimulate your visual cortex, you experience this ass coming from the skin, because he's never experienced vision in his life before. So that's kind of like a subtle distinction between what happens when you're blind from birth and you stimulate the visual cortex versus what happens when you acquire blindness later, so you know what vision is, and I stimulate your skin, it goes and stimulates your visual cortex, you interpret it as vision, you say, I'm seeing something. So there are other things we want to try on you, so we'll get in touch with you.
Okay. And Gene also was...
Yes? Okay, yes, right.
I'll introduce
right.
you to him.
So, in the case of phantom limb patients, when the arm is amputated, I told you about the mirrors, but here's another thing we discovered. When you amputate the arm, if you touch the guy's face, he'll say he's feeling sensations in his phantom arm. Now, why would this be? This is another example of plasticity in the brain. It's because if you look at the map of the skin surface of the brain, every point on the skin surface has a point on the brain. There's a complete map of the skin surface on the surface of the brain on a vertical strip. And it turns out that the face and hand are right next to each other in that map. We don't exactly know why, but they're close to each other. So when you amputate the arm, the part of the brain that gets hand signals is now hungry for an input, saying, I'm not getting any sensory input. So the sensory input from the face now goes and invades the territory corresponding to the missing hand. In addition to going to where the hand is, it now also invades the territory corresponding to the missing hand. So now when you touch the face, the messages go not only to the face area, as it should, but invades the hand area and activates the hand area. So every time you touch the face, he thinks you're touching his hand. And you can do brain imaging to show this is what has happened. So it's been a complete change in the climate of opinion in the last 10, 15 years towards thinking that the brain connections are highly malleable and adaptable, and they're all talking to each other, and one part of the brain can take over the functions of the other parts of the brain. And even aspects of vision like stereo can be educated in an adult who has never seen stereo before in his life or in her life. So all of this is in a sense good news, but how you harness it in the clinic is all from mainly from experimental work. How you harness it in the clinic, we're still some ways away from that, but there's tremendous scope for option. That's the good news. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very, very much. I would like to take some questions, if anyone has any questions.
Yes, I have one here in the front row.
For the good doctor.
Hello, this is Roger Peterson, and I actually almost got a PhD in experimental psychology, so I'm very interested in this stuff. I'm curious to know, doctor, if you have any knowledge of whether the brain is implicated in people who report synesthesias between senses.
Yes, that's a very good question. And synesthesia is an interesting condition which was discovered by Francis Galton, who's a first cousin of Charles Darwin. And he discovered this phenomenon in the 19th century. And he noticed that certain people in the general population were otherwise completely normal, had a following quirk in their brain. It's not anything negative. In fact, the people who have it enjoy it. And namely, these people, when they see a number or letter of the alphabet, see color. So 5 is red and 6 is blue and 7 is green. And when some of them, when they hear tones, like F sharp is blue and C sharp is green. But most common is numbers being colored and letters being colored. And people thought people were just nuts or crazy. And Galton showed that this runs in families. So there may be a genetic basis phenomenon. And he published this in a well-known journal, Nature, but was ignored for a long time. And when they imagine numbers, when most of us, when you're sighted, you remember numbers, and maybe some of you can illuminate this for me. Well, imagine when you say visualize numbers 1 to 10, they'll go from left to right. Left starts with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Days of the week starts from Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It all goes from left to right. And these people, when they visualize numbers, it's kind of like a elaborate convoluted shape. So they'll say, 1 is here in front of me, 2 is off to the left, 3 is on the top, 4 is back on the right side, 5. So you've got an elaborate convoluted number representation in the brain. We don't know why that happens. Maybe one or two of you has it here and you can tell me afterwards. When you try to visualize numbers. So this phenomenon of colored numbers is called synesthesia, and we started studying it, and we figured out that it's a real phenomenon. These people are not making it up. We designed different visual tests to show that they're really seeing colors. One of the things we did was brain imaging. If you take me and you show me numbers, there's an area in the brain called fusiform gyrus, and that area lights up. But if I see color, another area called V4, visual area 4, lights up. They're both in the fusiform gyrus, right next to each other, in a person who's sighted. Now, in a person who has number color synesthesia, and then if I look at color numbers, both area V4 and the number area both light up for me, because it's colored and it's numbers. So both the number area and colored area light up when a sighted person, normal person, non-synesthete, looks at a colored number. When you give it to a synesthete, even black and white numbers evoke color in the color area V4 in the brain. So you've shown that some kind of cross-wiring going on in these people, but unlike people who acquire blindness later, in these people the cross-wiring is congenital. Because of a gene mutation, these areas, color and number, which are normally isolated from each other, there are connections there, extra connections there, which are not supposed to be there. That's why every time they see a number, they see a color. Now, we have noticed, one of the things we have noticed is this condition, synesthesia, is about 7-8 times more common among artists, poets, and novelists than in the general population. Now, why would that be? Well, some people said, well, it's because artists, novelists are crazy. Well, we said that's not the reason. I think what's going on is, what do artists, poets, and novelists... See, remember I said synesthesia is based on genes, which cause excessive connections between regions in the brain which are adjacent, like V4 and number area in the fusiform nucleus. Okay? That part is clear. Now, that's laid down genetically. It's not acquired. Right? There's distinction between the number area and color area. But the connections between them are present at birth. So all of us have synesthesia at birth. But the excess connections are pruned away by these genes, so you got the adult architecture of different regions being specialized for different functions in the brain. So if this pruning gets defective because of one defective gene, or a small handful of defective genes, this pruning between adjacent areas does not occur, between color and number, so there's excessive connections between color and number, so you get number, color, synesthesia. But that doesn't explain why it's 10 times more, 8 times more common among artists, poets, and novelists. Now imagine the same kind of genetic change. Instead of just affecting number and color, instead of just affecting the fusiform area, affects the entire brain. There are more connections connecting different regions throughout the brain. What you're going to get is more opportunity to link different brain regions spontaneously. Is that clear? Okay. So what do you mean by metaphor? What do artists, poets, and novelists have in common? They're all good with metaphor and analogy and linking seemingly unrelated things. Like Shakespeare said, it is the East and Juliet is the sun. He didn't say Juliet a ball of fire. Okay? He was saying she rises in the east like the sun, she's radiant like the sun, she's glowing like the sun, she's nurturing like the sun. So he's making all these metaphorical links in the brain. What I'm arguing is in synesthesia, in synesthetes, there are excessive connections throughout the brain because of a gene mutation. And these excessive connections is causing some of them to be more creative than all of us non-creative people. So that's one kind of synesthesia. The other kind of synesthesia is acquired, like somebody like Tom here, where you have vision in one area of the brain, touch in a different area of the brain. Normally these are separate. If somebody were to touch me, I wouldn't say anything visual. If I close my eyes and move my hand into me, I don't see anything visual. That's because my touch area and vision area are separate. On the other hand, in Tom, what's happened is, because of the early visual deprivation, the touch sensory input from the touch from his hands has now invaded and is cross-activating the vision area in the brain. Therefore, when he moves his hand, he sees visual images. So this is another type of synesthesia, which you see. We've also seen types of synesthesia where if you touch the table or read real, letters flash in the mind, color letters start flashing in the mind. Again, because the touch input has invaded the visual areas in the brain. And if there are people with this kind of synesthesia, anybody here wants to contact me later through Mr. Carnes, through Tom, or even directly, I can give you my email and phone number and other details. You can all call us if you want to volunteer some of these experiments. And during the discussion now, in addition to asking me questions like this gentleman did about synesthesia, and I'm happy to continue on synesthesia if you want me to, I would like some of you to share your experiences like Tom did. Tell me, I experienced this. Everybody in my classroom, when I give lectures, ask, do people with blindness dream? Are they visual dreams? Right? Do they count visually? Do they dream in color? All of these questions. And you can pretend that I'm a student and I'm asking all these silly questions, some of them silly and some of them intelligent, and then you can give me your experiences.
Val Gordon, I have a cortical blindness from an occipital lobe stroke.
You do?
Yeah. And one of the main problems I have is hallucinations. I'm trying to figure out what new treatments they have for that.
So you have hallucinations?
Well, I could be walking down with my long white cane and all of a sudden stop for a tree so I don't run into the tree. And then I realize, hey, I'm in the house. There's no trees in the house.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I
could be walking down with my long white cane inside a building and stop so I don't bump into the tree.
Okay.
And realize that there's no trees inside the house.
Okay. You have a condition which is completely harmless, but it can get you into trouble, of course, but completely harmless, like it's called Charles-Bonnet syndrome. Yeah. And Charles-Bonnet syndrome can happen when there is visual deprivation, even in somebody in adulthood, late adulthood, like elderly person developing glaucoma, or even a severe cataract, any type of visual deprivation, it can even occur with damage to the visual cortex, and the patient starts having hallucinations. And sometimes they're disturbing, sometimes they're completely benign, like little people, circus clowns, comic book characters, animals, people. And you, many of these things are common themes in Charles Bonnet, or trees, like you said. And what's going on is, this is a very interesting point. Why do people with some types of blindness start hallucinating? The reason is that normally we think of vision, we think of bottom up. Visual information comes in from the retina, goes into the various areas in the brain, and there are 30 areas in the human brain. The visual information comes to these 30 areas and is processed for color, for form, for shape, for recognizing people, recognizing trees, objects. All of this is going on. But it turns out vision is, there's something more subtle going on here. Even if you're perfectly sighted and you're looking at the world, it's not just like object, the visual image goes to the eye and it's processed hierarchically and serially like a bucket brigade. First process the shapes, then you process the color, then you process the form, then you process the person's face and objects in a serial hierarchical manner. Memory plays a tremendous role even in just seeing. It looks as though, to put it crudely, anytime I see the world, I'm actually hallucinating. All of us are. And what happens is what's coming in picks the hallucination which makes most sense, right? So we're hallucinating all the time, all sorts of things. In the world, what the visual input is doing is selecting the one hallucination that makes most sense. It's kind of a different lopsided way of looking at perception. Now, if you don't get any visual input, then it goes open loop and the hallucinations become more real because there's nothing to stop it. Nothing telling you, look, there's nothing coming in from the world. So therefore, the hallucinations become more vivid. And this, we think, is the explanation for Charles Bonnet syndrome. Can I ask you another question? Completely legally blind?
Yes.
And in both sides or one side?
Both sides. And also have glaucoma, too.
Okay. Oh, you have glaucoma, too. I was going to say, do you have blind sight? That is, if something moves, there's a phenomenon called blind sight, where the occipital lobe, striate cortex, is completely damaged. There's no vision at all. But if somebody moves something in the visual field, the person says, yes, I saw it move to the left or right. I didn't see it, but I know something moved. Okay, this is called cortical blindness, blind sight. And I think the reason that happens is when you move something, it's tapping into a different pathway in the brain, the superior colliculus, and going to a different part of the brain. It bypasses the visual cortex and occipital lobe, goes straight to the parietal lobe, and therefore you start seeing things, which you can't see them consciously, but you say it's moving left to right. Or similarly, if I put something in the world out there and ask you to touch it, you say, well, don't be silly, I can't see it. But the funny thing is your hand goes straight and touches it. So your hand knows something your brain doesn't, or your visual areas don't. And that's again because of blind sight. It's because the retina is normal. I don't know about in your case, but often the cortical blindness, the retina is normal, sends signal to the superior colliculus, to higher brain areas, bypassing the visual cortex, and then informing the brain, reach out and touch here. So a lot of that reaching and touching and grabbing is not done by my visual cortex, but my parietal lobe. It's an autopilot without consciousness, visual consciousness entering into it, you reach out and grab something. So that's called blind sight. And I was just curious whether you experienced any of that.
I would actually, we have one more time for one more question, and that would be from Jean Lozano. I do want to state, though, Dr. Ramachandran did say, that to get his contact information. So if anyone has any other questions, please take him up on that offer. Jean, last question.
Yeah. It's kind of a comment question, Doctor. I have talked with Tom, and we both have, seems to be the same thing of where I have been totally blind for 42 years, and both eyes have been removed in the last 20, and that that I can move my hands in front of me, tap, like pick up your book right here, which I have, and I can see these things, and I sense like still color, and I also find that I'm walking. And if I decide to shut down, close my eyes, it's like as if you, as a fully sighted person, closes your eyes and you start to lose your orientation. And yet, I have no vision. So strange there. And then I also have that little bit where I still have, after 42 years, still vivid color dreams. And I do have, sometimes if you say the day of the week, I might associate a color with it or the numbers too. I don't do the reversals or anything like that. So.
I'm sorry, could you repeat what you just said? When you hear numbers?
Numbers, I associate color with them.
Okay.
Sometimes the day of the week, you might say day of the week, and I might associate that. Also with people's names, I kind of also associate colors with them.
Did this happen prior to your eye removal? Did it happen in childhood? Or always had it?
I seem to, that I can recall, since I've been totally blind, I lost my vision due to glaucoma. Okay. And I had partial vision.
How old were you then?
About 17 years old, okay. And I was a print reader.
Okay.
So it's just been interesting there. Besides, I have the sleeping disorder where I want to sleep in the daytime and goes into cycles where I'm awake at night and reversal.
Uh-huh. What about your what we call synesthesia, the colored numbers and all of that? Was that before you became blind?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
No.
It's pretty interesting. We might want to contact you through Tom.
Sure. And also, doctor, if there's a chance later, could you sign my book?
Oh, I'd love to, yeah.
I loved reading your book.
I'd love to do that.
Can you repeat the title of your book one more time?
Yes,
I've got two books. One is called Phantoms in the Brain. That's the more accessible one. Phantoms in the Brain. And the other one's new that's coming out is called Telltale Brain. And that's coming out in January.
What's that one about 5 years ago that was...
Yeah, Brief Tour of Consciousness.
Yes, that's
available as lectures too.
Yes.
If you go into BBC website, BBC Reith Lectures, and you can listen to it. BBC Reith Lectures Ramachandran, R-E-I-T-H Reith Lectures Ramachandran, you can listen to the lectures. And one of them is about phantom limbs and plastic. And one of them is about synesthesia.
Huh. Well, Dr. Contact information, if you have a telephone number or email.
Yeah, let me give you my lab phone number where you can always leave a message and one of my students will pick it up and convey it to me.
Yes.
It's 858-534-7907.
Repeat it one more time, please.
Yeah, 858-534-7907. I'm afraid not, but I can send, I've got an email if you can get somebody to send it to me, one of your caretakers or assistants or sibling or spouse, to send me an email. It's V as in Victor, Ramacha, spell that, R-A-M-A-C-H-A, Ramacha, V as in Victor, Ramacha, V Ramacha, at U. CSD, U is in uncle, C is in cat, S is in sugar, D is in doctor, UCSD, dot EDU, as in education, EDU. So it's vramacha at CSD.edu.
Thank you so very much for being with us today, doctor. The next item on General Sessions agenda is securing accommodations on standardized tests, common problems, and Jean's beating me over here with something. I don't know. Oh, backpack. Okay. Apologies. Common problems and legal developments. Carla Gilbright, staff attorney, disability rights advocates, from Berkeley, California. She is our next speaker. Carla Gilbright joined DRA in 2008 as the John W. Carson Fellowship Attorney. Her work focuses on issues faced by people with disabilities in Southern California, as well as advocacy for low-income consumers, including consumers with disabilities, before the California Public Utilities Commission. Oh, the PUC. Carla graduated with highest honors from Swarthmore College in 2002 with a bachelor's degree in linguistics after working as a political organizer for 2 years. She ended Georgetown Law School
and received her JD with honors in 2007. During law school, she served as article selection co-editor for the Georgetown Journal on Poverty Law and Policy, and participated in school federal legislation clinic, through which she was involved in the negotiations for what ultimately became the ADA Amendments Act of 2008. After graduating from law school, Carla served as a law clerk to Judge Ronald Gould, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle. Please help me welcome Carla Gilbright.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, everyone. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. It's great to be here. I've attended some of the other sessions, and it's been very interesting hearing what the CCB is up to, and appreciate that you've invited me here to speak about some of what DRA is up to, specifically in the arena of standardized tests. I want to back up just for a second and introduce or talk a little about DRA and what we do generally, just for those of you who aren't aware, because we are here in California, and most of us in the room here are in California, so there may be other issues on which DRA may be able to be helpful for folks. So Disability Rights Advocates was founded in 1993, and originally we started out in Oakland, but we're now in Berkeley, and it's a cross-disability advocacy, education and advocacy organization. We've got about 25 people on staff, a little over half of whom are attorneys. So we do a lot of litigation. That isn't all we do. If you know you're having a problem or just want to raise awareness about an issue, we can try to educate local governments or businesses in other ways with letters, phone calls, just pointing people in the right direction in terms of resources and information to comply with both federal law, like the ADA and the Rehab Act, as well as the various state laws that we have here in California that are very, very good in terms of accessibility, often stronger than federal law is. And then when necessary, we do litigation. Primarily, we do class action lawsuits, and CCB has been involved in some of those as a client. And we do some limited individual representation as well. Usually the individual representation that we do is, even though it's one individual, we think it's an issue or a situation that has wide-ranging impact and implications beyond that one person's situation. And often that is what happens with standardized tests, because when you're looking for an accommodation, it's going to be very fact-specific on what test it is, what your individual needs are, but dealing with those sorts of problems and getting a favorable resolution can have major consequences down the road for other people, other students, or other test takers with slightly different but comparable situations. So that's the big picture of what DRA does. And now I want to talk a little bit about, you know, this might seem obvious, but what do I mean by a standardized test, and what are some of the general developments, what's changed, I guess, in the last couple of years with respect to accommodations. And then I'm going to get into more specifics about what I see as the two types of problems, or not to be negative in necessarily calling them problems, but the two areas that you have to think about in terms of trying to secure accommodations. And that's the process of going through an accommodations request, and then the actual array of accommodations or menu of accommodations that you can choose from, which of those may be appropriate for a given person on a given type of exam. So first the process and then the sort of accommodations themselves. So what do I mean by standardized tests? Obviously you start taking tests all the way through K through 12 education and beyond. School tests that are given by the school, and even tests like the California High School Exit Exam, which everybody in the state has to take, are going to be governed through the school district and are going to fall under a student's IEP, because you're taking them in the school setting and they're required as part of your K through 12 education. So when you're talking about those kinds of exams, you're going to be looking at, you know, what accommodations does your IEP say that you get or that your child gets or the student gets. And if you have to seek, you know, if you're not satisfied with what you're getting or you don't believe that you're getting what should be, the appeal rights and protest rights that you have would be governed by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the IDEA. That's not so much what I want to talk about here today, although of course there's a lot that can be said about that. I'm talking about the exams that are governed by some sort of testing agency. So the first time that this would probably come up for most people would be the SAT in high school or the ACT. And then there are lots of other standardized tests like that that you might encounter later on in career. One that we deal with a lot, because unfortunately there are a lot of problems with it, is the LSAT, the Law School Admission Test, and for people who want to go to law school. Also, there's the Graduate Record Exam, the GRE, which most grad school programs require that you take. And there are many other exams, licensing and professional school exams, medical school, and for being certified in lots of different professions, for certified as a CPA, certified professional accountant, for teachers. And so basically any career path or profession that you may want to pursue, you're more than likely going to run up against some standardized test. And it's you get very specific very quickly when you sort of get into the weeds within, okay, what is the process for requesting accommodations for the LSAT? That's going to be different than the process for requesting accommodations for the GRE or the MCAT, which is the medical school exam, or the CPA exam. Each of those agencies that administer those exams have their own requirements and their own steps that they require you to go through, but there are some commonalities, some common themes that overarch all of those exams, which is what I want to talk about. So what has changed in the last 2 or 3 years? Basically, the ADA has always had a provision in it that talks about accommodations in exams and courses. So it's not just for exams, it also would apply to a training course or something like that for postgraduate, professional, and licensing. So most of the exams that I've just mentioned would fall within this category. And what that says is the course or exam has to be given in a place and manner that's accessible to people with disabilities. So the place part is you have to have, it has to be a physically accessible location. Or if it can't be given in a place and manner accessible, then alternative accessible arrangements have to be made. So what does it mean to say it has to be given in an accessible manner? And that's where you get into, you know, requesting accommodations and what sort of accommodations do they have to provide in order to say that the test is being offered to you in an accessible manner. So it's kind of vague. And to add some content and some specifics to that statute, that the Department of Justice promulgated regulations, which are still not all that specific, but they do give a little more detail. And one of the things that they say is that when an exam is administered to a person with a sensory or communications disability, the test must be given in such a manner as to best ensure that It measures the skills or material intended to be measured by the test and does not measure the effects of the person's sensory or communication disability. So basically what that's getting at is it's supposed to put the test taker on an equal playing field so that they're not disadvantaged by their disability, that they can just focus on being tested on whatever it is that the test is supposed to be measuring, and that they're not there's not some interference from, well, they could barely read the exam and that slowed them down so they couldn't answer all the questions or whatever the case may be. So that's what the law says. The other thing that is in the law that offers some guidance is there's a list of auxiliary aids and services. And this doesn't just apply to testing. It could apply to lots of different things. It could apply to what sorts of alternative formats a government document would be made available in, or that a store would make, or a restaurant, you know, would provide in terms of giving you access to the menu or things like that. But there's this general definition of auxiliary aids and services, and often the testing agencies will look to this to say, well, what do we have to provide in terms of another format besides standard print? And so what the definition used to include, it said readers, taped texts, and then it had other things that would apply to other disabilities, so sign language interpreters, large print, and then it would said, and other methods of making visually delivered material accessible. So it was kind of like a catch-all phrase. Now, one thing that's changed in the last couple of years, or is about to change, is that the Department of Justice, as I'm sure you, most of you or all of you know by now, has issued new regulations, updated regulations for the ADA, which are going to go into effect on March 15th, next year of 2011. And they updated the definition of auxiliary aids and services. They updated it to include assistive technology, and specifically also include screen readers and magnification programs. So screen readers and magnifiers are now written into the list of auxiliary aids and services, and so is assistive technology, so a broader term. But there's still that catch-all and all other methods of making visually delivered material accessible. So I'll get back to that in a minute, because one of the issues in terms of the sort of catalog of accommodations that you can request, that this has a bearing on that. So that's sort of the landscape of the law. The other recent change that may be relevant to some people here that I'll mention is the ADA Amendments Act, which Donna mentioned in the introduction. That went into effect in 2008. And it mostly talks about the definition of disability, which had been narrowed by several federal court decisions, Supreme Court decisions, over the past, 10 or 15 years since the ADA had gone into effect. And so the ADA Amendments Act does, among other things, is it says that if you use any sort of mitigating measure like corrective lenses or medication or adaptive technology to mitigate the effects of your disability to help you function, whether or not you have a disability is still considered based on what your situation would be without those mitigating measures. So for example, if you wear contacts or glasses and they correct your vision to the point where you can read standard print, although maybe with some difficulty, or you can read large print, but not if you didn't have those corrective glasses or lenses, your vision would be considerably worse and your ability to read would be considerably worse. Whether or not you have a disability, according to the law, is considered from the perspective without your corrective lenses on. So that may be relevant for some folks, because one of the things you have to do when you request accommodations is you have to show, do I have a disability that entitles me to accommodations? And if it's a visual disability, you have to show what your uncorrected or your corrected visual acuity is, and you have to go through your diagnostic tests or your records from your ophthalmologist. And so if you're sort of on some borderline question where someone's testing agency is trying to determine, are you disabled enough, are you blind enough to qualify for accommodations? The ADA Amendments Act has liberalized and broadened the definition of who has a disability and who's entitled to those protections. So those are the sort of recent legal developments, and now I want to go into the more detailed walking through of the two pieces, the process of requesting accommodations and then the accommodations themselves. So in terms of the process, and I want to leave time at the end of my talk to hear from you guys in terms of questions or experiences or comments that people have, but I'm just speaking from my own experience and sort of what we've heard so far from people of what the problems are. And this tends to, these issues sort of cross disability lines, you know, in terms of what the reason is that you're requesting the accommodation. They cross testing lines. The same sorts of issues are rising with all different exams. So I think these are fairly general points. One thing that a lot of people are running into and finding difficult is when you request accommodations, and this varies somewhat, you know, from exam to exam, but there are fairly onerous documentation requirements that you're asked to comply with. So it's not just that you write in, you send a letter, or you fill out a form saying, I want to take this exam, I'm blind, I read Braille, I need the exam in Braille, and you know, sign it and they take your word for it. They want, most testing agencies want you to get a form filled out by a treating physician, and they want that professional, that medical professional, to be fairly specific about the accommodation you need and why you need it. And if you're getting this form filled out or this affidavit written by an eye doctor, an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, that person is most familiar with what you can and can't see. That's what they're treating you for. They don't necessarily know what technology you use, what devices you use, or how you take exams. So they're not all, you know, always in the best position to give this detailed information that the testing agency is asking for. So what we've seen some people do to try to work within this system is to get these affidavits filled out by low vision specialists or rehab specialists or assistive technology specialists who have worked personally, you know, with the applicant and can speak in more detail about what devices they use and why they're helpful and why other type of accommodations like a human reader, for example, would not work as well. And so they're, you know, thinking a little bit outside the box in terms of who the professionals are who can speak to your needs and your individual situation. But because a lot of the testing agencies do require the visual acuity data and the, you know, what is your sort of score on the eye chart type data as well, that often means you have to get two of these things filled out, one by the ophthalmologist and one by the other professional. So there's a fairly burdensome requirement in terms of seeking out these professionals and getting them to fill out these forms and understand what they need to do. A related problem is that, and this is something that I find particularly frustrating, the testing agencies ask you to go out and get all this data and information, but they don't necessarily give it deference and take your, you know, not your word, but these people who've gone out and filled out and signed the forms for you, they don't necessarily accept what they say. They have their own consulting physicians and optometrists or you know, people who they deal with, who look at people's applications and will sometimes dispute the information that you've sent, even though they have never, you know, examined you or, you know, examined the test taker personally, have never met them. And we'll say, no, let's say, for example, you're saying that, you know, you want to read the exam in large print and have double time because it takes you longer to read. They'll say, well, you know, someone with this eye condition that you have should be able to complete the exam in the regular time or in time and a half. And we, you know, we decide you don't need that. And they deny your request. So, you know, you're kind of left with, now what am I supposed to do? And that brings me to the third point about the process, is there are issues of timing that often come into play with these accommodations requests. In order to get, so many of these exams are only offered, you know, two or three times a year, you know, varies again based on exam, but they're not offered every week. And so if you're applying to take the exam at a certain time, you need to be accommodations request process usually several months before that time, which requires people with disabilities to plan much further ahead than somebody who doesn't need to request accommodations would have to. For a lot of these exams, if you aren't going to be requesting an accommodation, you can apply a month or even a couple of weeks before and say, okay, now I'm ready, I want to take this exam. If you want accommodations, you need to be thinking a lot further ahead, and because you need to run around and get, you know, all this paperwork done. And the flip side of that, you have to really have all your ducks in a row and prepare early, is that if they get back to you, and they often, you know, again, this sort of varies from agency to agency, but in many cases, they don't get back to you until a week or two before you're supposed to take the exam. And if when they do get back to you, the answer is no, we're not going to give you the accommodations you asked for. We're going to give you these other accommodations that we think should be sufficient for you, or we're not going to give you any of the accommodations you requested. You're in a difficult position because you either have to then take the exam with accommodations that aren't what you believe you need, or try to go through an appeals process, with providing, you know, extra documentation or extra evidence, but your time to collect that extra evidence is very fine. You don't have a lot of time. In some cases, there isn't even an appeals process. Or to do a more formal appeal or possibly bring litigation, you have to postpone taking that exam. Or the other thing that you could do is take the exam knowing full well that you may not do as well because you didn't have the accommodations you needed, and then use that fact that you didn't do well as evidence in your in your impending litigation. But that could have professional consequences, either to delay or to have a not very good score on your record and to have to, you know, explain that to people. So it leaves people in a very untenable position often when they don't get these accommodations because the decision of the testing agency is made at the last minute. So those are some of the struggles in terms of the process of requesting accommodations that we've seen. And as I said, I'm anxious to hear from people in the audience if there are other types of problems that I didn't mention or other situations you want to bring to our attention. In terms of the list of accommodations that you can have, the issues for people who are blind or visually impaired, or not the issues, but the options, historically, when the ADA went into effect and when accommodations started being routinely offered in this way that I'm talking about, were usually Braille, not always, but Braille is actually fairly common as an alternate format for exams. Large print, which now what do they consider to be large print? What's the size? I've seen both 18-point and 24-point font offered, but that's often not specified. So that's something where if you are in a position requesting accommodations, you want to be very specific about what sort of large print you need. And then human readers were the other one. You know, folks have different experiences with human readers. Often on exams, especially if it's not a reader you know, trying to go through that content with a reader can be very frustrating if the person doesn't have the command of the specialized vocabulary or terminology of whatever the test is about. And then, is there a question?
Actually, we'll probably have time for one, two questions max when you're finished, so okay. Sorry about that.
Okay. Okay, I'll try to speed myself along a little bit so that there's time for questions. But so readers have is a mixed bag, I guess, is what I'll say about readers, because so much of it depends on who your reader is. And so one of the things that has been tried, and there was a settlement with the between the Department of Justice and the Law School Admissions Council that runs the LSAT that I mentioned on this, some other testing agencies also offer it, is that if you choose to have a reader as your accommodation, you be allowed, well, there are two ways it go, either to bring your own reader that you already know and have worked with, or to have a reader that they assign, but to have time to practice with the reader ahead of time, so that you know that, you know, you're confident with this person and that's going to work out. And you can get some time to sort of teach them how you want them to read and how you, to get better at working together so that you're not dealing with that under the conditions of the exam for the first time. So that's all I'll say about readers. So what has recently happened within, I'd say, the last 10 to 15 or 10 years is pre-recorded versions of the exam have come onto the field as another option, where it's tape, cassette tape in the beginning, and now more commonly it's a CD with the questions recorded onto it. Now that alleviates some of the issues with a reader, but you know, you still have the issue of how you navigate within that recording to, if you want to repeat questions or repeat answer choices or go back and forth, how easy is it to navigate, you know, rewind it or fast forward and get to the specific place that you want to hear again. And then more recently still, people have started requesting to be able to use screen readers and screen magnification programs, JAWS or Zoom Text or Magic, on a laptop. And that's been an area of some controversy. DRA is actually serving as the legal counsel for one student in California and three students in Maryland who have requested to take the bar exam in their state using screen readers or screen magnifiers. And the court in California said that they should be allowed to do it, and the student actually took the exam that way. The court in Maryland said that there were concerns about the security of putting an exam onto a computer, and so they did not allow the students to use their screen readers, and so they had to take it with human readers instead. So we'll see how that all shakes out in the end, but interestingly, at the same time that people are fighting to be allowed to take tests on a computer with adaptive software and being told no, you have a growing number of exams that are only offered on computer. And like the GRE that I mentioned earlier is one of those, that you have to go into this you know, computer lab and take it on one of their machines, and the machines and the software that they are running these exams on are not compatible with screen reading software. So unfortunately, what sounded as if it may have helped to level the playing field for blind and visually impaired people has actually become sort of a complicated arena where, because the testing agencies that are doing these computerized tests use their own software, they've had to come up with sort of workarounds for how to make it accessible. So ETS, Educational Testing Services, which offers the degree, has spent many years developing its own self-testing software to read the questions out loud on the GRE. But that means that people, blind people who want to use that option, as opposed to having a reader read it to them, have to be trained how to use this special ETS software instead of using the software that they already know how to use. So that's sort of an evolving area, is how to get access to these tests that are done on computer and often have to be taken on computer. So having a Braille copy of the exam is not an option, because I've learned with respect to this the CPA exam that I mentioned before. What questions you get next on the exam depends on how you answered the last question. That's like an interactive exam. So if you get question number 8 wrong, it gives you a different number 9 than if you get question number 8 right. And so with that dynamic content, they can't prepare a large print or braille exam ahead of time. And you have to do it on the computer either with someone reading you or with some sort of software that they invent. So those are some of the issues in terms of specific accommodations. And I guess at this point, I will open it up for questions and comments.
And we have time for, yes, we have time for one or two questions, depending on how long the question is and how long the answer is.
Carla, it's Mitch Pomerantz.
Hi, Mitch.
Hello, Carla. I have a question and a request. Even prior to the California and Maryland cases, it seems to me that there have been suits against law school admissions council, ETS, and other entities for at least 15 to 20 years. Yet, we still have these kinds of issues, and we have these issues just within the last 2 weeks, and that will be my request of you in a moment. But in the last 2 weeks, I have been made aware of a young lady in Missouri who was denied an accommodation. She wanted to take the LSAT using screen reading software. She was provided a reader whose first language was not English, and a scribe who had to leave the room several times during the test. My request is that you and I have a chance after this, after your presentation, at some point before you leave, to talk about this privately. But you know, with the litigation that seems to have been around for 20 years, why do we not see a whole lot of progress with these entities? They are flouting the law, and our students are the ones suffering as a result.
I agree with you that it's frustrating, and I certainly would be happy to and like to speak with you later about that specific situation. But in terms of why is compliance better, you know, one of the problems, I guess, that, you know, there are some settlements that are on the books, like the one I mentioned with DOJ and LSAC about being able to train your readers, which we continue to hear that LSAC is ignoring and not meeting the terms of the document that it signed. So even when, you know, you have settlements and things that are supposed to be binding, some of these agencies are, I said, flouting it. And I think part of what makes it difficult to enforce it as individuals, I mentioned the catch-22 that people are put in, that if they fight over the accommodation and really make a stink about it, it can delay their plans for going on with their careers, or it can cause them to, you know, get a bad score on their record that they have to explain. And so a lot of people are dissuaded from doing that. You know, people are often dissuaded from filing suit about a lot of things, but I think this is a particularly touchy issue and highly personal issue for many people. And so it's possible for the testing agencies to sort of scare people into taking substandard accommodations in many cases, and that's why, and it's difficult to deal with it on an institutional or class-wide basis because, as I said at the very beginning, the accommodations that people need, what the law says is it has to be done on an individualized person-by-person basis, and you know, not everyone is going to need the same accommodation, not everyone is going to want to use a screen reader, some people would prefer braille or large print or whatever. So it's difficult to take on cases on a class-wide basis, and so that's why perhaps getting the government to take more of a role in enforcing, particularly the agreements that it itself is a party to, could be a way of getting around the chilling effect on individuals, the fact that it's hard to tackle this as on a class-wide basis. But I don't have a great answer, because you're right, it's something that continues to be a problem, and that some of these agencies are being very blatantly cavalier about just denying people.
If someone with more vision than we have can get us together after you're finished, maybe we can get together and chat.
One last question, please.
You were talking about this is Charlene Arnell. You were talking about the computerized tests. And if a person is supposed to be getting like time and a half or twice, double time to take the test, because sometimes they're computerized and you'll have so much time for a section or whatever, how am I to be assured that I was actually given the time that I was told I would?
Well, I don't know if you're speaking about a specific thing that happened to you or more generally. Before I end, I'll give my email address, and anyone who has a specific issue they want to talk about should feel free to get in touch with me. But generally, the way it's supposed to work is that if you're taking the test under different conditions from the bulk of the test takers, there's a proctor who's supposed to be monitoring. Often it's you're in a separate room, or there's like segregated, right? You have the people who are taking accommodated tests in a different room from everybody else, and there's a proctor who, among other things, is supposed to be monitoring the passage of time and making sure that you don't go over your time, but that you get all the time that you're entitled to. Now, if that doesn't happen in a certain situation, I guess one thing would be to have your own way of monitoring time, have your own watch or something with you, and if they're trying to cut you off early, you can say something right there, no, I'm supposed to get, a full hour or something like that, because it's always good to have both a copy of the letter that granted your accommodations with you in the testing room, so that if any sort of dispute arises, you have the written confirmation right there of what they said that you could get. And then if the issue is time, that you have an independent way of tracking the time, so that if there's a dispute over that, you can, you can speak up for yourself. Okay, so I guess if that was a question, I will let you all know how to get in touch with me if you have questions about this or problems, testing or anything else that you think that DRA may be able to help with. My email is kgilbride, that's K-G-I-L, B like boy, R-I-D like dog, E, at dralegal.org. That's K Gilbride at dralegal.org. And
thank
I guess
you.
Maybe I'll just give my phone number too, in case people prefer that. My work number is 510-665-8644. And thank you all very much for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Clara. Okay, our next item is combined hearing and vision loss impact strategies and resources. Kathy Kirscher, excuse me, there's talking going on my left as well, so I apologize. Okay, Kathy Kirscher, National Representative, Helen Keller, National Center, Southwest Region, San Diego, California. We can go ahead and give Kathy a very nice welcome.
Thank you all for having me come today. I appreciate it. I see a lot of friendly faces that I know in the audience. And Carla, I will say there's a newly admitted deafblind student at Harvard Law School starting this fall. From California. She's from the Bay Area. So the really cool thing about that story is the Disabled Student Services at Harvard got in touch with Helen Keller's National Center long before she darkened the door this fall and asked about accommodations. They hooked her up with her former university, Lewis and Clark in Oregon. So whoa. I was very impressed so far with Harvard, and I'm hoping that she does well in the law school. So we may be talking to you again, Carla, but I hope not over a legal issue. I wanted to title my presentation today, Everybody's Mumbling, because that's how I feel these days. And I'm in my mid-50s. I have teenage kids still at home. And a couple years ago, any of you who have been around teenagers, That group, they mumble. They talk fast. I can't understand any. I can hear him say mom and then blah, 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 blah. And my teenage son a couple years ago had his little cell phone and he held it up and he said, listen to this. We were downstairs. We have a two-story house. We were downstairs and I saw him push a button and I heard nothing. And I said, what is it? And he said, you can't hear that? My teenage daughter came running down the stairs from the back of the house, and she was holding her ears saying, turn that thing off. And I thought she was teasing. I thought they were setting me up for something, because I used to have super sensitive hearing. I could hear my former husband's watch tick when he took it off. Now, he's been long gone, so I think I can't hear that watch anymore, whether he was still around or not. But apparently the kids days have a ringtone, the ring that rings on your cell phone. It's called the mosquito ringtone, very high frequency. And one of the first things we all lose as we age and have a lot of noise pollution, genetics, other things, illness going on, are our high frequency noises. And so when my children did this ringtone, they told me at their high school only one teacher in the whole high school could hear it. So they call each other with this little crazy ringtone. Yeah. So I'm going to start with a little trip down memory lane, my own memory lane, because I think if I talk about a few things, it will touch on, since I didn't title my presentation, Everybody's Mumbling, and it had a very long name about impact strategies and resources. I think maybe if I tell you a little bit as through the ages as I understand it and what I've experienced in the field of both hearing loss, vision loss, and deaf blindness, we might have some answers along the way. But we have some resident experts among you all. And there's a newly resurrected deaf-blind committee. So the first thing that I will say is that when we use that big word deaf-blind, it's kind of a catch-all to include everybody with hearing vision loss, a combined hearing vision loss. It's easier than say than combined hearing vision loss or dual sensory loss. But I got into the field, or actually in my family, my grandmother was blind. And so I knew her I was born in the 50s, and as a child in the 60s, my grandmother had macular degeneration. So she always had a little bit of vision left. But back in those days, in the 60s, she was a voracious reader, and I know some of you will remember this. There weren't very many things in large print. In fact, the only thing I remember that she had was the Reader's Digest, which was a good magazine, but it was the only one that she had access to back in the day. She had very little technology. She would change her magnifying glass out as her vision progressively got worse. She had no other technology. She wouldn't have used a white cane if somebody paid her $1 million, one of those. And she relied on family. And I was part of the family. I was her little mini-sighted guide. Well, when I first met my former brother-in-law, he was deaf, and I was 18 years old at the time. And he wrote notes back and forth with me for about 6 months, and one day he threw away the paper, and he said, go learn sign language. Well, some of you, I see Karen Schrouder in the audience from Department of Rehab. She's one of the very few nine people I know that have learned sign language. Sign language was always meant to be a visual language. And a lot of people that I end up working with end up using tactile sign language. And it's a different language altogether. Karen, being blind, learned tactile. She had a deafblind friend. Correct me if I'm wrong, Karen. But her friend taught her tactile sign language. Very difficult to learn with no vision. Again, it was meant to be a visual language. My brother-in-law, who was deaf in the 60s, went to deaf school, and he was one of, we have 307 million people in the United States. One out of 10 people in the United States, most prevalent ability is hearing loss. So one out of 10 people in this room should experience a hearing loss statistically. My brother-in-law was one of those people born hearing, but became deaf as an infant. We call it prelingual deafness. He became deaf from spinal meningitis before he had formal language skills. So he learned at his home back in the 60s, before we had all these pre-K and 0 to 3 programs in education, he had what we call home signs. So they had a home sign for mom, for dad, for cookie, for brother. But when he went to deaf school, his parents dropped him off. He went to the deaf school in Tennessee, and they dropped him off the first day. He was 6 years old, and they had no language to explain, we'll be back in 1 month. That's what they did back then. They said, leave him for a month, let him get adjusted, and then you come back. They had no way to even tell him. And the heartbreaking story was my former mother-in-law talking about leaving him there that day without any way to really explain to him. He's fine now, he's got a master's degree in rehab and doing well, but I'll tell you one thing about him, he still doesn't have great English skills. English is still his second language. And if I write emails to him today, some of you might read them and say, now how did he get a master's degree when his English is that poor? And one of the things with him, he missed those critical language years of 3 to 5. By 5 years old, all of us in this room, I would imagine, would have about 2,000 word vocabulary in our native language. 2,000 words is a lot of language. Even Helen Keller herself, the namesake of our agency, she became deaf-blind about 18 months old. They don't know exactly. They think maybe she had scarlet fever. But if you guys have been around an 18-month-old child, they have a lot of language. You can ask them, do you want some water? Do you want a cookie? Do you want to go to bed now? No. They can tell you a few things at that age, too. So that famous scene in the Miracle Worker movie where Annie Sullivan was fingerspelling the water pump with Helen Keller, the word W-A-T-E-R, and finally got it. Helen was able to hear that word when she was a young child. And so somewhere in that plasticity of her brain, and I have to tell you, for those who couldn't see, both speakers before me did their entire presentations with no notes. So, but yeah, pretty impressive group here. But my brother-in-law went to school. Again, he's one of the few. When we look at hearing loss in the United States, we say there's 10 people with hearing loss. Only about 1 million of those are profoundly deaf, like my former brother-in-law. The other 29 million are hard of hearing. And back in the day, too, 1979, there was a man named Rocky Stone. And Rocky founded the group called Self-Help for Hard of Hearing, S-H-H-H. They've now changed their name to Hearing Loss Association, HLA. But one of the interesting things about Rocky himself, he became hard of hearing, severely hard of hearing. He was in World War II, and I think the story went that about age 19, a mine exploded very close to him, and that damaged his hearing. Any of you ever been to a rock concert and you come out and your ears are ringing? Okay, that means you damaged your hearing. So there is a group of aging rockers I always talk about now. I can never remember who started it. I think it was one of the guys from The Who or The Rolling Stones. But all of that noise affected their hearing. But Rocky had a one-time major event that damaged his hearing. And then, in later years, he also developed macular degeneration. And I kept hoping and praying that Rocky somehow would get combined hearing vision loss, deaf blindness, more talked about within Hearing Loss Association. And it never really happened. Their focus really is hearing loss. And that's part of my dilemma. When I go out, I work for an agency, every single person I work with has to have some combination of both hearing and vision loss. But usually I'm talking to blindness organizations or agencies or deafness organizations, and never the twain shall meet. And so I'm here to kind of talk about some of the things that might be affecting all of us. And hi, Mitch, are you looking for your seat? I joined Helen Keller National Center back in 1987. And back in those days, I worked in the Seattle office. And just so you know, I call Seattle the Mecca for people who are deafblind. And you know what? It is the Mecca. If you were in that big D, culturally deaf, deafblind using group that still has a little bit of vision, I would tell you it's a Mecca for that group. If you go further out in that circle, it's not so much the Mecca for people who are hard of hearing and blind, who don't use sign language. And so back in 87, most of the people that came to see me were culturally deaf using sign language. Even back in those days, there was a really feisty group, and they said, "You're leaving us out." And the sign for being on the fence, if you have your dominant hand and you have your index finger and your middle finger pointing straight out, sort of like the peace sign, you wiggle the peace sign, those are your legs. So you can, with those legs, straddle a fence, which would be built with your left hand. And on that fence, this group in Seattle, the Feisty group, said, "We're not really in the deaf world. We're not really in the blind world. We're up here on this, straddling this fence with our legs, and we don't know where to land." And they started a group up there called, they called themselves Metamorphoses. And I loved this group. It was the group that really got things going and got me thinking more about just other than that deaf, culturally deaf group. And it also, one of the people that started it was one of the first people I ever met in college who had Usher syndrome type 2. Usher syndrome, there's three different types. You can be born profoundly deaf, you can be, and that's type 1, with retinitis pigmentosa. Type 2, people are hard of hearing. Type 3, people usually become profoundly deaf by age 40. And there's a bigger group in Finland with that type 3, but a lot of people here have type 2. And back in the day when I was in college, if you talk, his name was Dale, if I talked to Dale in one of my classes, and I went to college in Oregon, he would be able to see me pretty well. He would also be able to hear me if there wasn't a lot of background noise. But we lived in a town that was dry. The woman who gave the land to this college in Oregon said, "You can have the land if you never sell alcohol here." So the nearest little bar was 3 miles away in Independence, Oregon. When we would go at night, and one of the problems with retinitis pigmentosa, and those that you, of you that have it knows, night blindness. So at night, we would drive to this little bar in Independence, Oregon, and then there would be a live band playing. So Dale, who had been hard of hearing, low vision in college just that afternoon, at the bar that night, was functionally deafblind. And one of the things Dale did in this process through his master's degree was learn sign language, again, with vision that wasn't so great. One thing Dale did this year, he got cochlear implants. And he's doing great with those. But, you know, that's a whole nother topic. Yeah. Somebody had their hand up. Did you want to say something?
I actually wanted to ask if you want to start taking questions or give a little more of your presentation, and then maybe we could take one or two. What's your preference, Kathy?
Oh, I can do anything. If anybody has anything to add, again, there's some resident experts among you all. Okay. I'm hearing sighted, again, in my 50s, losing hearing as I go, and vision too, but not from something specified. Okay. One of the things I will tell you statistically, for older people over age 65, what they say statistically is 33% of people have hearing loss. That's a pretty, that's one out of three people over age 65. And one of the things that I do is if I look at somebody and they look my age or older, I start employing some of the guidelines for better communication as if they have a hearing loss. There is somebody with their hand up, right?
Yes, there is, and just really quick, letting you know that our next presenter will be going on at approximately 3:50, so okay. We'll go ahead and take the question.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ken.
If I can, very quickly, I just wanted to find out, I found, of course, when I was 19, 20, I was able to hear it well over 20,000 cycles. Sometimes I'm lucky now to be able to hear at about 40% at 4,000, and we're talking about hearing, maybe hearing aids within a year or two, the way the audiologist is speaking. What about the tinnitus? Is that also a factor that's involved? Because I have that constantly. So not only do you not have the high frequencies to hear any longer, but you have this high frequency that's constantly in your head. Is that something you've noticed as well?
And this is Kathy responding back. Tinnitus is that ringing in the ear. I actually have experienced it. If you drink, there's quinine in gin. Gin was my drink of choice back in those days. Again, you drink too much gin, I guarantee you there's going to be some ringing. And it does impede hearing loss. Unfortunately, there's not a cure for that. One of the things some people use is white noise in their ear. And one of the things I will talk about a little bit is just environmental factors that impact. And for those of you that didn't see it, right at the beginning of this whole general session, Ed summoned a person from the hotel to turn off the fan that was right above this main table. And that fan, you know, if you don't have hearing loss or you're not paying attention to background noise, you might not have even noticed it, but it was so, to me, noticeable when it turned off, because we all relaxed a little bit. We were all able to hear a little bit more. And so when you talk about that tinnitus, that's the kind of constant noise that people hear. Unfortunately, a lot of people report hearing it worse at night when everything's quiet, when you're trying to go to sleep then, and that's when you hear it more prevalently. And so that's been an issue for a lot of people. Somebody else had their hand up over here.
How do we get a hold of you?
Oh, Helen Keller, and I'll just tell you a little bit. We have a national training center in Long Island, New York. We only take about 28 students at a time. Not very many people I come in contact with ever go there, but I work in California, I work in San Diego, but I also work in four different states, Arizona, Nevada, California, and Hawaii. I know you're feeling sorry for me. I always say, somebody's got to do Hawaii, it might as well be me. So I've got cards with me up here, and we've got some programs that I do want to be able to share with you at the end. There is somebody with their hand up way in the back. So I'll meet you afterwards. I'll find you and give you my card. All right.
Thank you.
Yes, Kathy, this is David Hanlon.
Hey, David.
Hi. Yes, I'm very familiar with Kathy and the Helen Keller National Center. We went there last year, Roy and myself, you know, Roy Harmon, myself, and Donna Sanchez and a few other people from CCB were able to go to Sandpoint, New York, and it was a wonderful experience. It was very life-changing. I just wanted to let all of you know that I have been asked to head up the Deafblind Committee for CCB, and that today at 4:30 in room 1421, the hospitality suite, we are going to have our first meeting. So if you're available and you have an interest in deafblind issues, please come and join me. Thank you.
Yay, thank you, David. And one of the things I will tell you is that I think deaf blindness, a combination of hearing and vision loss, there's so much information that we just get incidentally without even trying. And one of the things, not so much, but even how to find my office. What about Helen Keller? What can we do for you, or what can some of the other agencies do? We should have about 125,000 people in the state of California with combined hearing vision loss. We probably know about 1,000 of them. That's all. And part of that is access to information. And I usually tell kind of a funny story about driving with a deaf blind woman about 10 years ago, and she said she was hungry. And in my car, I had a bag of Funyuns because my kids wouldn't eat them. And those are those fake onion rings, if you haven't had them. And she asked me, she signed, they must be new. And I told her, no, they've been around about 10 or 15 years. And she ended up getting mad, not at me, but saying, why didn't somebody tell me that there were Funyuns? You know, it wasn't about the onions. We know it wasn't about the Funyuns. I was in Hawaii working 2 weeks ago, and right before a presentation I was going to give, I walked into one of those ABC stores, and right at the counter, they had a new flavor of M&Ms. They were called coconut flavor. I never saw them before. I did see the pretzel flavor, or I heard them on TV, but this was coconut flavor. The other thing that they had right on the counter that I never saw before, you know how Hawaiians are crazy about Spam?
Yay.
Right? Okay. This is Spam-flavored macadamia nuts. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, if anyone's going to Hawaii, I would like some Spam-flavored macadamia nuts, please.
All right.
They're all gone.
All right. They leave really bad aftertaste, I can tell you, in your mouth. But it's not about not knowing about the nuts or the chips or the M&Ms. It's about, think about, if you don't know about those right now, okay, I let you know. But think about how much information you miss on any given day, any week, any year. I had a guy a couple years ago, deafblind in California, who I would tell you was pretty connected. He emailed me about a week before the presidential election, and he said, can you tell me again who's running for president? And, you know, sad for me, because I really would have told you he lives in Fresno, that he was better connected. He's good at email, not so good on the internet. Totally deaf, totally blind. So, you know, just when I think we're making progress, I get knocked down a few pegs and think we've got some work to do. Again, David and his committee are a good example of, you know, we're really trying to get some things going in the state and with CCB as well. I will tell you that one of the services in deafblind community, again using that word deafblind to include everyone, is support service provider, SSP, one-on-one help for people with essential tasks like mail reading, grocery shopping, going to medical appointments, but not just dropping you off transportation, actually going in, maybe help filling out forms. There's only 19 formal SSP programs in the United States. The closest one, you know, we think we're all up in it, we know what we're doing in California. The closest one to California has been, up to 2 weeks ago, in Tucson, Arizona.
Wow.
And 2 weeks ago, Helen Keller, our little office here that's not far from here, about 3 miles from here, a woman died in San Diego County about 5 years ago who had both hearing and vision loss. She was hard of hearing, severely hard of hearing, losing vision. I don't remember the cause of vision loss. She set up a sensory garden in El Cajon, which is east of where we're at right now. And when she died, she left some money specifically to provide services in this community for people that have both combined hearing and vision loss. And so the San Diego Foundation came to me. They did their homework nationwide. And they came back and they said, we really want to provide some service for for this population. So we're doing it through Helen Keller. It's a little pilot project. But what our hope is that this little pilot project in San Diego County, which actually is a pretty big county, I think it would be the fifth smallest state or something like that if it was a state, we're trying to expand that more broad. I had some deafblind people in Los Angeles area that heard about this project and they said, not fair, we have more deafblind people in Los Angeles. We have to be, you know, she designated this money specifically for San Diego County. But our feeling is if we do a good job with it here and provide some one-on-one services that people really benefit from. They ask us to do a quality of life survey to really survey people before and after they receive services to see, has there been a change? And I can tell you that a lot of you guys sitting in this audience right now are not among them, but you know there's times that you get isolated. There's times some of you here that have both hearing and vision loss, even in a large group, feel isolated because of the background noise. You can't really hear conversation. And so those are all things we want to look at and change. Another thing, the woman that, I can't remember her name, that spoke this morning really shortly about a new initiative, a new act that passed in July. There's a piece in the legislation that just passed giving $10 million for technology to people who are deafblind per year.